Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 235, and it's back to high drama circa 1873. Before that, just some news, unbelievable as it may appear. Apple Podcast has named the History of South Africa pod as one of their top 10 best so far podcasts of 2025. They've asked me to say so in an email formally, so this is saying so. And a regular musket salute is in order. Thanks to my fantastic listeners for helping make this podcast resonate. I'm truly grateful. And thus to our story this episode. The Chwayo glamped and crowned, shipst installed, Masipula poisoned. It's early 1873 and King Mpande Kasenzangakhona of the AmaZulu has been buried and the process of selecting a new king has begun. The Chwayo Kampande, his son, is to be the new regent. Or is he? This wasn't a simple matter. Succession disputes had riven the Zulu nation from the days since Senzangakhona had died. The last internal ruction had led to the Zulu Civil War and the shattering battle of Ndundukasuka near the Tugela River in 1856. I dealt with this significant moment in episode 209. Mpande was still king at that time, but Chwayo and Mbuyazi, his two eldest sons, were vying to be formally nominated as the king-in-waiting. Mbuyazi was defeated in the battle, vanquished and killed, leaving Chwayo in de facto control of the kingdom, though his father remained king. Mbuyazi's followers, including five other sons of King Mpande, were massacred in the aftermath of the battle, but some escaped. Succession had been murky ever since 1816, when Shaka had supplanted his half-brother and the presumptive heir, Sigujana. Chwayo may have been the eldest son of the King Mpande Kasenzangakhona, and many of the Isukulu supported Chwayo, but Mpande favoured his next eldest son, Mbuyazi. He was Mpande's second son by a widow of Shaka, and his technically higher status was Mpande's justification that the elder Chwayo should be bypassed. Just to add layers of complexity, English settlers and Boers had involved themselves in the dispute and fought alongside the two AmaZulu forces at Ndundukasuka on opposite sides, Chwayo's Usutu, as they were known, and Mbuyazi's Isixhosa. The Battle of Ndundukasuka saw the Isixhosa defeated and 20,000 people were killed, Mbuyazi's warriors, along with their women and children. One of the central characters of our story was John Dunn, who had supported Mbuyazi, but switched sides afterwards and was helping Chwayo collect firearms by the early 1870s. When Mpande died, Chwayo would turn to the British in Natal for recognition because he faced two major threats. One was from the Boers to his north, from the Suid-Afrikaanse Republiek. They had taken control of the disputed territory around northern Vryheid, Utrecht, and the foothills of the mountains below Volksrus. The other threat was internal. Chwayo was beholden to some powerful Zulu chiefs in the north who'd helped him defeat Mbuyazi, and most of these opposed Chwayo doing any deals with the British. They were traditionalists. The British, they said, would disturb the indigenous rituals. Chwayo saw things differently. He was playing a much bigger diplomatic game. If he could convince Natal's Commissioner of Native Affairs, Theophilus Shipston, to ride into his territory and formally crown him king, this would keep the Boers at bay and simultaneously undermine those northern Isikulu who were conducting a whispering campaign. In this geopolitical tango, Shipston understood the power game only too well. He'd been installed in 1846 as Native Commissioner of Natal and virtually ruled the black population there, as well as trying to rule the AmaZulu north of the Tugela too. White trader John Dunn enters the picture. He'd been anointed as a senior chief in the area south of Ishowe, along the coast near the Amatukulu River. Dunn had dozens of wives and was a central figure in the coming conflict. His skill in diplomacy and intelligence gathering were useful to Chwayo. However, his musket trade was even more important to the Zulu king. Chwayo also relied on John Dunn when it came to correspondence with Shepston. Most of the messages and letters between Chwayo and the British were channeled via Dunn. Furthermore, Chwayo considered Dunn to be an accurate and reliable source of information about what was going on amongst the settlers and British officials in Durban and Pietermaritzburg. Would Chwayo be able to manipulate Shepston for his own purposes, or would the wily official, as historian John Labunt calls him, exploit the situation in Zululand to strengthen colonial control over the affairs of the kingdom? It was through Dunn that the invitation was sent to attend Chwayo's coronation, and Shepston accepted immediately. He intended to bestow Britain's support on Chwayo by crowning him. Shepston was aware of the political theatre of this moment and entered Zululand on the 8th of August 1873 with 110 mounted men of the Natal Volunteer Corps, dressed in splendid blue and white uniforms. These were made up of detachments of the Natal Carbineers, the Richmond Rifles, the Vienna Yeoman Cavalry, Alexandra Mounted Rifles, the Victoria Mounted Rifles, and the Durban Volunteer Artillery. Trundling along with them were two field guns to create even more of a spectacle. Also along for the trip, the equally splendidly dressed 300 black troops under their Isinduna. For these men, it was the first time a black volunteer force had crossed the Tugela and entered Zulu territory. Most were under the impression that this was a trick by Cetshwayo to get them into Zululand because they were almost all refugees of the various Zulu civil wars. The last time Shepstone had visited a king, it was Mpande, and he'd suffered severe intimidation, surviving that by the skin of his teeth. This time, he was taking no chances. Cetshwayo had an eye on a number of Mpande's other sons who were living in Natal, who sought protection from the British against Cetshwayo. Can you see the layers of tension? Shepstone, who could be facing his own death by Zulu, the Zulu refugees dressed as British troops, the British colonial force facing memories of Piet Retief. "Come to I," said the spider to the fly. But Cetshwayo had his own layers of tension, Mpande's other sons. Mkungu and Mtonga were the most important of these, with Mkungu living in Vienna close to the Zululand border, and he had amassed a sizable group of warriors. Mtonga lived near Newcastle, close to the disputed territories, schmoozing the Boers of the South African Republic. But it was going to be the powerful Mantlakazi clan who'd almost upend everything. As usual, things were not as they appeared. Cetshwayo was not going to wait for some British official to crown him king of his own people, so it was with surprise and some anger that Shepstone reacted to the news that Cetshwayo had already gone through with a Zulu coronation, and it happened like this. When Mpande died, Cetshwayo at first had kept out of the way at his old Ondini great place down the Mhlathuzi River, not to be confused with his modern museum called Ondini in Ulundi. Cetshwayo had no choice. Was he to wait cap, or rather blue crane feather in hand, for this official to crown him and thus weaken his position amongst his own people? John Dunn was advising him to do just that, but Dunn was concerned that his own lucrative trading position amongst the Zulu would be adversely affected by some kind of falling out between Shepstone and Cetshwayo. The old man and respected chief Masipula and other senior councils had warned Cetshwayo that they considered his being crowned by Shepstone an utterly demeaning moment. It wasn't about white and black. It was simply that Shepstone was a foreigner. First order of business was Cetshwayo had to submit to Zulu rites of passage and secure the blessings of the royal Amadlozi chiefs before any British coronation rite. Cetshwayo thought the British rites largely unimportant, as long as both sets of crownings took place, and there was the contradiction. For Shepstone, the British coronation was front and centre. Anything else meant his empire would be taking a back seat. For traditionalist Masipula and the others, it was the Zulu rites first. As we all know, these rituals are not idle moments. They're historical, nay, biblical. And if you mess up in the midst of what a community believes, you lose everything. The once and future king Cetshwayo began to move in July 1873, just before sending word to Shepstone. The period of mourning Mpande's death now over. After gathering his Amabuto regiments, he set off in full attire, having packed up his entire Ondini great place. Dozens of his Isigotlo girls, his women, his harem, carried his goods and chattels. As they travelled up the Mhlathuzi River into the thickets, which held a vast array of wild game, Cetshwayo ensured that all protocols would be followed, including the purification rituals of a great hunt and in Nhlambo, where the king would be indirectly washed clean by the Amabuto washing their spears in blood. All evil influences that had gathered force during the mourning period after Mpande's death in October 1872 would be dispatched. There were so many followers trailing Cetshwayo, they formed a circle 8 kilometres in diameter, then began beating the thickets, moving inexorably together, squeezing game in an ever-diminishing circle. They wiped out so many animals that oral history legend has it that it took many years for the animals to recover. Some never did. The Mhlathuzi Valley is part of the Zululand Thornveld and coastal lowland forest bioregions, rich in biodiversity and a home to a mix of savanna and riverine thicket and woodland ecosystems. The thickets support a diverse array of fauna. Thick bush contain nyala, bushbuck, impala, warthog, duiker, vervet monkey, branded mongoose, small spotted genet, monitor lizards, hornbills, hoopoe, African fish eagles, many other birds. Just don't cook the animal carcasses on Tomboti wood, which also grows there. Spirostachys africana, a distinct wood. We avoid it like the plague. The sap is the nasty part. Freshly cut wood exudes a milky latex rich in formal esters, highly irritant cytotoxic compounds. It's called extremely hazardous class 1A cellular poison. If you bribe with it, you could go to hospital pretty swiftly. Tomboti is not firewood. The smoke is noxious. It contaminates food, causes many stomach cramps and diarrhea if meat is cooked over these coals. It's a common tree along the Mhlathuzi Valley, and all of us who grew up there can spot it from a mile away. The sawdust and smoke irritates the eyes, the skin, and the airways. You can get serious eye injuries and even go blind. The latex has been used as a fish poison and on arrow tips. Another clue to how strong it is. Gichwayo's few thousand people began to move along from there at a leisurely pace, hunting and eating as they went, avoiding the Tomboti. The would-be king didn't walk these few hundred kilometers as his predecessors like Shaka and Dingana would have. Oh no, he went by wheeled transport. John Dunn's trap, a small two-wheeled light carriage drawn by horses. And at night he slept in Dunn's large white tent, joined by some of the women of his Isigodlo. Glamping 1873 style, you could say. He had a head start on Shepston, who was a few weeks behind him. Shepston's party would also ride through the Inkwaleni Valley, further upriver towards the Kwamondi mission station, run by Norwegian Hans Paludan Smith Schroeder at Melmoth, or Mtonjanini, as it's called today. An interesting man. In his pictures, Schroeder looks vaguely like Arnold Schwarzenegger. He launched 12 mission stations starting in 1850. The first baptism took place in 1858. He converted almost 300 people. Even more remarkably, Schroeder is responsible for authoring the first complete grammar of the Zulu language, and his scholarship ranged beyond linguistics and theology. He became a student of Zulu culture and history, as well as an expert in the wealth of plant and animal life in the area, that remained after the Great Hunt, of course. Shepston was fluent in Zulu. Perhaps he spoke isiZulu with Schroeder instead of trying to converse in their different European languages. Gichwayo, way ahead, bumped and rolled on the horse-drawn carriage through the Zululand bush, heading towards the Mahlabatini Valley, and he was more nervous than he let on. Outwardly, it was all triumph. The king heading towards his coronation, lauded by the homesteads on the way. But rumours abounded, rumours that the northern chiefs were ganging up on him. There was some truth to these rumours. When the Amabuto, representing the northerners, joined him on his journey, he had devised a show of strength. He'd observed the Boers show off their guns. Just as a kind of FYI, Gichwayo collected all his men with firearms, a couple of hundred, lined them up, and ordered two volleys to be fired into the air to impress the northern warriors. They were duly impressed, and word filtered back to their chiefs that Gichwayo was indeed imbued with the power of a king. A few days later, his retinue reached the Mtonjanini Heights, and Gichwayo looked out over the white Umfolozi Valley. Mtonjanini means spring of water, and from here the springs flow towards Umfolozi in the north or the Mhlathuzi River to the south. Down in the Mahlabatini Valley, they could see tendrils of smoke rising from numerous amakanda. A similar scene unfolds today. The mountains there should be visited. They are grand indeed. They are not the sharply inclined Cape Fold type, best described as a kind of broken highland plateau made up of rolling hills and isolated ridges and deep river valleys. The terrain is dissected by small streams and tributaries feeding into these larger rivers like the White Umfolozi and the Mhlathuzi. The land rises dramatically from the surrounding lowlands, offering panoramic views. And now Gichwayo was lapping up the views. The land, as far as he could see, was his. Gichwayo descended after taking in the scene and marched along the Emakosini Valley to Emakeni Ekanda. Mpande had rebuilt Emakeni, founded by Indaba Ka Makeba. There is a significant Isivivani, or sacred cairn, there, imbued with spiritual power. This same enclosure was later used by Senzangakona, Shaka Zulu's father. That was to be the site of Gichwayo's coronation, resonating with power and significance, and his followers arrayed themselves there, preparing for the moment. Gichwayo waited 3 days for the rest of the AmaZulu clans to arrive, spending the time sacrificing cattle to appease the spirits. The tension rose. During their wait, some of Mpande's people from Kwa Nodwengu forded the Mfolozi, bringing with them a large herd of cattle to feed the growing throng. The day of coronation dawned, and Gichwayo sat on an open area Yeah, and McCandy. A large group of people appeared on the plain to the north, drawing closer by the minute. It was Zibebu of the Mantlakazi. He'd succeeded his father Mapita, the most powerful man of the northern barons, as John Labunt calls them. Mtwana Mapita Kasojiyisa, to use his full name, and by inference Zibebu, were of the most respected family lines. To explain, Indaba was the earliest known chief of the Mantlakazi, followed by his son Jama, who was later the grandfather of Shaka. So Jiyisa Kajama succeeded Jama, the head of the Mantlakazi left-hand house, a key ally to Shaka, especially during the conflict against the Ndwandwe in the early 1800s. Mapita Kasojiyisa then inherited the leadership of the Mantlakazi under Shaka. This positioned him as a major chief of the authority over the northeastern Zululand region, encompassing former Ndwandwe territories. And now here was his son, swaggering into view, coolly intelligent, forceful, sporting his isikoto at a jaunty angle, almost as a Frenchman, his beret, and the future nemesis of the royal house, Zibebu. His warriors lined up behind him. Trouble was brewing, because they were in battle order. Kechwayo was perturbed. He'd kept a close eye on Zibebu over the previous few years because this man regarded himself as an equal. The Mantlakazi had helped Kechwayo to victory at the Battle of Ndonokasuka, so he owed them one. Zibebu was also courting the white traders and the British establishment in Natal, ironically, building his arsenal of muskets, a complex threat. Moments in time, surges of reason and emotion, thus the torrent of history, a stony second. And to balance this moment, Zibebu actually owed Kechwayo, who had defended him when Mpandi had wanted to kill him. I mean, nothing is simple. About a kilometre away, the Mantlakazi formed up in battle order. Hushed murmurings followed. It was said the Mantlakazi were here to grab Kechwayo. As if there wasn't enough drama, Hamu of the Ngenecheni marched up from the west with his warriors, and almost simultaneously, Mnyamana of the Buthelezi trotted up as well. Kechwayo sent his Izinkeku, his royal attendants, to calm down Zibebu's Mantlakazi, assisted by 200 of John Dunn's hunters who were all brandishing their muskets. Zibebu calmed down, first crisis averted. All the warriors formed up in a grand circle, watching as Kechwayo slaughtered 20 head of cattle as a sacrifice to the ancestors. These weren't just any old cows. They had been selected for their health and beauty, then herded to Kwa Nobamba, known as the place of unity and strength. And here they were imbued with the power of the birthplace of the Zulu nation. It had been built by Senzangakona's father, Jama. It was where the sacred symbol of the Zulu lay, the Inkatha. Nations across the world have these rituals of origin, whether American, Russian, South African, or English. We all need affirmation of our beginning. It unites folks. By ritually slaughtering these 20 cows, Kechwayo was symbolically binding himself to the throne and his people. A great party took place that night. Thousands and thousands of people assembled in the light thrown by great fires. A new king was celebrated. As the sun rose the next day, it revealed that most of the northern chiefs had left with their followers and had formally proclaimed Kechwayo king. Hamu of the Ngenecheni stepped forward. Was he going to break this moment or hold his peace? He held his peace, making a point of insisting that he could be trusted and that Kechwayo was the valid regent. But history doesn't paint a sweet pattern. There's always a sharp point to a satisfying second. And this involved Masipula, the old man who'd been so instrumental in advising his younger mentee. Kechwayo had shifted his supporters to Ilambungwenya, the Ikanda of Mpandi's mother, Sunjia, further along the Matlabatini plain. It was Masipula's last move. He died there a few days later, on the 16th of August, 1873. The Zulu court mourned for 4 days. John Dunn wrote later that Masipula had been frozen out of a meeting of senior advisers when they'd gathered to discuss Mpande's reign. The snub was a dismissal. He'd been fired. Masipula then turned to Dunn and said, "Goodbye, child of Mr. Dunn. I have finished my part and am now going to lie down. Look after your own affairs. I have no more voice in matters." He'd been at the heart of Zulu affairs and matters since Dingana's time and through Mpande's. But Kechwayo had been infuriated when Masipula failed to follow through on orders for two of Mpandi's wives to be killed and join him in the grave. Masipula also had a name for ruthlessness, and Kechwayo feared him. Such a man could not stay alive. Oral history speaks loudly about what happened. Kechwayo brought some of the women of Masipula's Izigodlo into his confidence. They were the ones who prepared Masipula's millet beer. Kechwayo slipped them the poison that they popped into Masapula's favourite tipple. Each chief had their own personal hollowed-out gourds, their beer tankards, and Masapula's gourd was now deadly. A throng gathered, most unaware of the event playing out. Masapula clutched his gourd, drank deeply. He immediately began to sweat profusely. His muscles trembled. He staggered from the gathering, Gajwayo watching unmoved, with some of the women who knew sitting at the entrance, mocking him, saying, "Farewell, father." He died just before midnight. Later, his corpse was taken to the Mkuzi River homestead where he was buried, the end of the tether that connected the Zulu kings. It was after all of this drama that Theophilus Shepstone actually appeared on the Mtonjaneni Heights, where only a few days previously Cetshwayo had stopped to peer at his realm. The date, 25th of August. Shepstone sent word to Cetshwayo he was there, who then kept him waiting. It was a calculated mark of disrespect and a slap in Shepstone's face. He had ridden across the countryside, and he was forced to accept Cetshwayo's power. Eventually, on the 28th of August, the two met. More days of discussions continued at Elambongwenya, focusing on Zululand-Natal relations, how to stop Boer aggression, and laws which Shepstone and Cetshwayo agreed should be promulgated at the coming coronation. Laws? Whose laws, you may ask? Which is what the Zulu chiefs were asking once word got around. The full farcical coronation took place on the 1st of September 1873, spring. Shepstone's men erected a large marquee at the top of the cattle enclosure near the Izigotlo. The councillors were unhappy because they considered this so-called coronation an insult to the way of Zulu, not to mention a threat to their independence. A little British military brass band burped away as Shepstone, dressed in virgin white uniform, rode in ahead of the mounted volunteers. The Amabutu were also in their finest regalia, jostling around the cattle enclosure. Shepstone spoke fluent Zulu, and he addressed the assembly, formally declaring Cetshwayo as king in the name of Queen Victoria of Great Britain. Shepstone didn't stop there. He proclaimed a number of laws that the AmaZulu were expected to abide by, starting with the promise that the key centre of justice of the power over life and death actually still resided with Cetshwayo. This was going to be the bone of contention later. The king spoke, saying that all the chiefs assented to Shepstone's laws. "We will govern the country under Cetshwayo, our king, and we look to England to support and recognise Cetshwayo as the king of the Zulu nation." Thus spoke the chiefs, and it was the centrepiece of future tension, as you'll hear in episodes to come. One last thing before Shepstone went home. They had to have a photograph, a selfie of sorts, which exists. Cetshwayo, dressed in a tawdry scarlet and gold mantle and even more bizarre feathered diadem, specially designed supposedly to appeal to an African's tastes. I don't know who the designer was, but that's how it's described. The photo is black and white. We know of the colours by way of Shepstone's reports and other descriptions. Cetshwayo is seated on a plush upholstered armchair, surrounded by a motley crowd of bearded colonials. The two artillery guns then fired a 17-shot salute, taking many minutes to load and fire. This was the end of the coronation, and on the 3rd of September, Shepstone led his men back into Natal. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog. You can email me from there. Until next, salagatli.